Welcome to You Here Now. This is season 2, episode 1. I'm Amy Adams, and I'm joined today with my co-host, Whitney Walker. Today's story, Place of Safety, features Veronica Monet and her experience of growing up in a cult and how that impacted her life.
Hi, Whitney.
Hi, Amy.
How are you? I've missed you. This is our second season of You Here Now, which is very exciting.
Yeah, it's been a while. I'm very excited to be into the second season together.
Yes, and we have a very special guest that we both know separately and who is like all... It's all kind of intermingled and come together. And her name is Veronica Monet.
Yes, the fabulous Veronica Monet. She's amazing. I had her on my podcast, and what an incredible story. And then the work that she's doing now, the way that she's just transmuted her experience into everything that she does, it's just exquisite. I adore her. She's wonderful. That's why she works so well with us. We're all so wonderful. It's a great talk we have.
Yeah.
A great story to hear and her perspective. So I didn't get to hear all this. So, cause her and I's conversation on my podcast was much more about her work now and, you know, some of her other experiences. And we really just glossed over the part about the cult, which is hard to do, but we did. We were just kind of like, and there was the whole thing. I was in a cult as a young woman, a child into an adult, but now I'm getting to hear more of it. I've never really heard this perspective from someone before.
Yeah.
I don't think I've known anybody directly in a cult. Maybe.
Or maybe that you do. And like she said, there's some shame around where she came from. So it's not was like a thing that she normally talks about with people. So
yeah.
That was really interesting. It's got to be tough being born and also being born into a situation that you don't even really know that you're in a cult, which is fascinating.
Yeah. Well, that's how it usually happens. I mean, like so many other things, it's, you don't realize it and you, cause it's normalized. It's all, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's not until later that you recognize, oh, I think there was something about this that wasn't right and may have been inappropriate or damaging, traumatic. Then it comes to the surface. And as you know, Veronica just shares so, you know, eloquently about what that's like to unfurl that reality.
There was even the process of discovery through the years of her adult life.
Yeah. And again, I think that so many people can relate to this, whether or not you're in a cult, when something that you thought was one thing, you realize was another as you get older. And I like that she kind of hints and shows that it doesn't have to be a full-fledged cult or a full, because she also discusses incest and molestation and abuse. And it doesn't have to be this like full force thing. It can be, in many different forms, right?
Yeah.
And people can, that can come to light and really be very upsetting and jarring to people.
Yeah. And I think it was interesting too, because she said recently another family member had passed away. And then this also brought up an opportunity for people to discuss their past without feeling so inhibited by the living almost, like, cause we feel protective of our families, even if they're not all, I don't want to say like angels or saints or, but I mean, even if they don't have all the best intentions or there's the other aspects of them that now can kind of come out.
Yeah.
To be open and talking about things and healing family wounds and healing. I think one of the things that we did talk about in our, as everyone will find out as they listen, was about healing in the long term. But I think one thing that when we heal ourselves, there's that ripple effect out into the whole community too, which
yeah.
I think, so healing is so important. And, people, I think sometimes like self-care and wellness get a bad name because people think it's selfish or something. And I know this is like big, big issues and deeper problems, but any kind of healing that we can do and any kind of like love of self will only benefit the greater good without it being a narcissistic love. Like it's, I think it's so important that we, what is that quote? Physician, heal thyself, right? Or some, anyway, I don't remember. I actually just, I have it written down somewhere. Anyway.
I hear you. I hear what you're saying.
Veronica's story, a place of safety.
It's an interesting thing being born into a cult because it's all you know. So I grew up listening to the founder's voice on the radio. And then later on, I listened to his son on television. And they had these broadcasts that were preaching the end of the world. And unbeknownst to me, because I was so young, the first time that the founder said the world was going to end, I didn't realize that it didn't. Because I didn't know it was supposed to end. But I grew up in a soup that was all about how we were God's chosen people and everybody else was pretty well screwed. They were all going to be burned up in a lake of fire if they didn't repent. So we were taught to separate ourselves from the world. And my father took that to an extreme. And he wasn't really going to church. He kind of believed in it, but he had his own little cult going. Called it a cult of one in a lot of ways. So I got a kind of a double whammy. My mom's part of this Christian cult, doomsday cult. And my dad was mentally ill. So he took that and ran with it. And we didn't go to school. I studied correspondence courses at home. And we were isolated from the world on so many levels.
Earthly father.
My dad got injured. He worked at a sawmill site and he got injured. So they put him through training. And for that brief period of time, we were on welfare. And that was in the city. We lived in Eugene, Oregon, and in the middle of the city, rented a little house. And then he got his diploma. It was a technician. It was basically training as a welder. I guess he had to take some math for that. And it turned out he was super smart. So he got great grades. But he went on to become a welder. And at that point, we moved to Portland for his job. And he welded on ships and trains and trucks. And he was very proud of that because he had been raised by transient fruit pickers. My grandparents had 11 kids and traveled around and picked fruit for a living. My dad had an eighth grade education and he hated public schools, so he didn't have any interest in me getting an education at all. But my mom was kind of frantic when he said we weren't going to be allowed to go to school, and she found something called Calvert School out of Maryland. And it was not religious oriented, to my knowledge. It was just a correspondence course for getting a grade school education. So that's what I did from grades 1 through 8. And then for high school, I went to something called American Schools, which was another correspondence course, and it wasn't religious, but interestingly enough, it was attended by Donnie and Marie Osmond. So I got my high school diploma from the same organization that they got theirs. That kind of made me feel halfway human. I never knew if it was a legitimate education until I got to college. And then I found out that my grades were superior and I actually became a tutor on campus. Well, the cult did not dictate that children had to be homeschooled. That was what my father wanted. But they did say that we could not vote. We were not supposed to be involved in the government, anything to do with man's government. That was the dogma. We were part of God's kingdom. And so as God's kingdom, we did not vote in elections. So there was also a lot of stress on not celebrating any birthdays or holidays. So there's a tremendous amount of pulling away from the culture. But it was called the Worldwide Church of God. And there were services throughout the entire globe. lots and lots of people were in this cult. So it really didn't matter if you moved, there was always going to be a church wherever you went. So my mother would just switch churches if we moved.
Friends.
Well, when I was ages 4 to 6, I didn't have any friends at all. I had, there was a neighbor cat who, he only had 2 legs and he would come visit me. And my father, as I told you, was mentally ill, so he's really afraid of germs. So I wasn't allowed to pet this cat. My dad said it was dirty. So I used to try to pet this cat with a blade of grass. And my dad hated that cat. And I remember on one occasion that he kicked it about 20 feet up in the air. And it went flying into some bushes. And I thought, well, there went my only friend. And I was probably 6 at the time. And my dad slammed the door, went in the house and slammed the door. And I was just really bereft. And the cat poked its little head out of the bushes and came over purring at me again. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking that was, for me, in that moment, that was the bravest, most courageous, most honorable person that I knew. I was so impressed with that cat. And I've carried the memory of that cat with me my whole life. It was such a contrast from my father, who seemed like he was just a cowardly bully. And when we moved, my father moved us into a little tiny travel trailer. It was only 18 and a half feet from the hitch to the bumper. So my sister and I went from having a house where we had a bedroom and we had a swing set in the yard. So even though we didn't have any friends and we weren't allowed to go to school, we were still able to run around and play like kids do. But now all of a sudden, I'm about 6 and a half, my sister's 4 and a half, we get put into this little tiny tin box and you can't move around and you can't play. And we went to live in the mobile home parks, which really, since ours was just a travel trailer, we were stuck in the travel trailer section of the mobile home park in Portland, Oregon. And I developed two friends, basically two friends that mattered to me. And one was the person who was the manager of the mobile home park, his daughter. She was 2 years younger than me, and she had the same name, and she would come visit me. And I say come visit me because I wasn't allowed to leave that little tiny square piece of concrete and grass that the trailer was parked on. It was forbidden for me to step even onto the driveway where the cars drove. So she would come visit me and we would play little games with our dolls. And I had little tiny matchbox cars that I'd play with too. Mm-hmm. And the other kid that I really, really liked was a boy my age. And one time I leaned over and kissed him on the cheek and my mother saw it. And I don't think I got to play with him again after that. I was 8 at that time. I wasn't allowed to go make friends. They have to come visit. So imagine, this is a very hard thing for people to imagine, I understand that, but imagine an animal, like you've ever seen a horse in a pen. It's behind a fence, right? And it can't get out. So if you want to talk to that horse, you have to go over and talk to it. The horse can't come to you. I was in a prison. I was not allowed to go talk to people. They had to come to me. And if they found me interesting, then they would. And I had a very gregarious personality from birth. So kids, by the time we moved to the little tiny trailer next to my grandma's house in Carlton, Oregon, I was allowed to play in the backyard because it had a fence. I wasn't allowed to play in the front yard because there was no fence. Mm-hmm. And I could not go visit anybody. I developed a friendship with the girl that lived next door. And I used to talk to her over the fence, but I could never, ever go to her house. And she lived right next door. Kids liked me. And so they would come into my backyard. And I actually formed a little softball team in my backyard. And then my father, in his insanity, took away the ball and the bat. And there were no more friends.
Sisters.
She's just 2 years younger than I am. we were always together. She was really essentially my only friend. We were each other's best friends, only friends, and our only classmates. And so we did everything together. And she was shy and I was outgoing. So I would talk to people over the fence. And then she would be my little tag along. We were poor, so we actually shared a bed. We were very, very close at one time. We're not now, but at one time we were super close. Actually, Mom sewed our clothes and dressed us the same, so people thought we were twins.
Grandparents.
My grandparents belonged to Assembly of God Church, which is what my father had been raised in and what my mother had been raised in. And at the time, I didn't know that because it was kind of, I don't know, it was, you know, when you're in a cult that thinks it's the one true way, they don't really talk about other things. They just talk about the cult's beliefs. So what I learned was that Grandma and Grandpa were wrong and they were probably not going to make it to everlasting life.
Are they really damned?
I was a very independent little thinker. So let's go back to that cat that I think is more brave and courageous than my dad. I just saw my dad as this mean bully in a lot of ways. And my mom was getting hit. So I didn't like him very much. And I didn't see her as being very strong. So I think for me, I didn't necessarily totally buy it. I was curious. It's a weird thing for me being born into this. I believe it. And then there's a part of me that wants to rebel against it and not believe it. What I remember is my other grandmother was a Mormon. That would have been my mom's mom. So we got the Mormon, the Worldwide Church of God, and the Assembly of God. And these three people, my grandmothers and my mother, would get together and argue about what the Bible verses meant. And I can remember at 9 years old just thinking, there's no love in these conversations. These people are so mean to each other, and they're arguing over whether or not it's okay to drink wine. And why are they doing this? And there was part of me that was just like, I don't want to be like them. But I'm 9, and by the time I'm 12, I want to become a devout member of this cult. And I read the Bible from cover to cover the year I'm 12. And I'm hoping that I will be inspired with the Word of God and feel the Holy Spirit come into me. And my mom will be happy with me. And I will be saved from the end of the world and whisked off to something they call the place of safety. Our founder had bought 2 huge jet planes. You know, they were like passenger planes. Big, I don't know what you call them, but anyway, the kind of plane you get on if you're going to fly to New York City from San Francisco. He bought 2 of those. And now keep in mind, there's like 100,000 people in the church around the globe, and he's going to fly us all off to someplace in the Middle East to avoid World War III. Well, that's not numerically possible. And yet, everybody believed it. We all believed that we were going to go to the place of safety. While I wasn't sure I always believed the dogma, I was afraid not to. I was afraid I'd die if I didn't. Here's some of the rules. At 6 a.m., I had to get up. And the first thing I had to do is I had to go pray for exactly 20 minutes. And my mother gave me a list of the names of all the pastors in our cult. And I had to go behind a curtain in our little trailer, and I had to get on my knees, and I had to pray for 20 minutes for these pastors who I didn't even know and I'd never met because I wasn't allowed to go to church, and they weren't actually in the particular chapter of the church that Mom was going to. They were like the big guys, you know, they were famous in the cult, but I didn't know who they were, and I didn't care about them. But I had to, you know, get on my knees and pray for God to protect them and guide them. So that's all I knew about prayer. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a personal experience. There was nothing about it that was uplifting or meditative. It was a task that I had to complete. and my knees would get sore, and I'd start falling asleep, and I'd have to wake myself back up, and I felt bad about myself that I was breaking the rules. And I was supposed to pray silently, so my mom couldn't necessarily catch me falling asleep. But the fact is that I'd always really been very conscientious. So if I did something behind my parents' back, I told them, I confessed. No, and I feel guilty and afraid of a lot of things. So I think fear and guilt was a big thing that was pounded into me.
Subcults.
He used the Worldwide Church of God as an excuse for everything. So mom is going to those services every Saturday. That was the other thing that we set ourselves apart. We always observed the Sabbath from sunset to sunset. So Friday sunset, we were supposed to stop watching TV or working. And then we'd have to go to Saturday sunset. But my dad was very, very controlling. And my mom's cult said that the husband is in charge. So wives submit unto your husbands, even as the church does unto Christ. That was the quote that was held over our heads. So my mom could not disagree with my dad. She had to go along with what he said. So he would take the isolation and the male dominance and use it to his advantage. He wanted to control our family because he had sexual designs on my sister and I. And that's a pretty common pattern for pedophiles. Want to keep the daughters home and not let anybody have any contact with them and kind of own them. And he took naked pictures of us when I was 6 and my sister was 4. This is so weird because I just learned that our founder was a pedophile. That he raped his daughter and had a sexual relationship with her for since she was a little girl until she was a full-grown woman. So for like 20 years, he was having a sexual relationship with his daughter. So my father grew up in a family that was full of incest and sexual assault. And, you know, I'm sure he was traumatized by that and carrying it forward. But I'm just like, why was our founder also into his own daughter? So there's a way in which it's, I don't know, accepted or something. And then I found out other people in the church, one of them went to prison for molesting his daughter. It's just like something that nobody ever talks about. It's certainly not in the scriptures. It's not like part of the cult. People are not talking about it. But there's some way in which it's facilitated. My father's mental illness was obsessive compulsive disorder. He's died. But he was afraid of germs and he got afraid of people, you know. So that was also the thing that motivated him to want to have a lot of control. And I know, you know, he went to some church services. And what he used to tell me is, I don't know if there is a right church, but if there is, this is the one. The services went on for about 2 hours. So I actually started going to church with my mom when I was 14. I finally was able to talk my dad into letting me go somewhere and do something. And I picked on church, hoping that he'd feel like that was holy and good. And I'd be with my mom and I'd just be around the church people. And it worked, but not until I was 14. I was isolated from the world from birth until I was age 14. And then my only social outlet was church. And what I found in church were, well, I found men who would have sex with me. fortunately, that didn't happen until I was 17. But that is where I had sex, was in church. And I also got drunk in church because our church believed that you could have alcohol. And of course, you weren't supposed to get drunk, but people did. And they had dances. So the first dances I ever went to were at church. And the services went on for 2 hours. They were very fire and brimstone. Nothing happy going on in church services. It was even the special music was like a dirge or something. We were supposed to follow God's law in the Old Testament. Now, that didn't mean we had to perform animal sacrifices, thank God. So, but we had to, once a year, we had to observe the days of unleavened bread. So we clean all the leavening out of our house, and I would have to get down there like on my hands and knees with a toothbrush, cleaning it out of the corners, cupboards and everything. And then for that week, we had to eat flatbread. And we also had the Day of Atonement once a year. That was a 24-hour fast. We weren't even allowed to drink water. So I brushed my teeth, but I had to spit the water out real fast. And then we had a bunch of other holy days too, but they didn't mean much to me except that, you know, you're not supposed to work and it's like the Sabbath. And so you're just a sunset to sunset kind of thing. No, I did not look forward to the days of unleavened bread. There was so much housework associated with that. And then, although the rye crisp that we ate was okay. That part, I guess, was all right. But no, I'll tell you what I did look forward to. I certainly didn't look forward to the Day of Atonement when you don't get to eat or drink water for 24 hours. That was horrible on a kid, especially. Mm. But when the Feast of Tabernacles was every fall, and that was fun. You get to go on a trip. And our whole family used to go to that. Now, Dad didn't go to the services, and I wasn't allowed to go either. But it was still a Feast of Tabernacles to me because we'd pick up, move the little travel trailer with us, and we'd go to Squaw Valley in Northern California. And it was beautiful, and I'd swim in the lake. And then when I got older, when I was 15, I started going to the Feast of Tabernacles with my mom. And there was dancing, and there were boys, and there were concerts, and there was eating out at restaurants. And that felt like a celebration. That was like the first, that was like the only time a year where I felt like people let themselves have fun. And I've gone to these cult services in recent times with my mom, because you know, you never know a child's perception. And I went to one because she has dementia, and I was trying to take her to church for her. Mm-hmm. So I'd say like 3 years ago, I went to a service, and the pastor spent a whole hour talking about how meditation was consorting with the devil. That if you close your eyes and breathe, you're talking to Satan. He was against Oprah. He was against yoga, meditation. And I was like dumbfounded because I didn't remember being taught that. I just knew that I felt afraid of those things when I was a teenager. And then when I went to the church service, I was like, oh, that's where that comes from. Oh, that's why my mother told me not to do those things. Oh, I get it now. Okay. It's actually a church doctrine. So like I have an uncle who's really way into the Assembly of God religion, which is an evangelical Christian religion. That's what most of my relatives are into that. And they will try to convert you and tell you that they want to make sure you get to heaven and that you need to give your heart to the Lord before you die. That's very different than Worldwide Church of God. Worldwide Church of God is like, we won't even tell you where our church services are because we are the lost tribe of Manasseh and you're not. So goodbye. And our services are secret and you're not allowed to know where they are and you're not allowed to join. But of course we do need your tithe money. So some of you have to be able to allow to come in, but it was weird. You weren't even supposed to tell anybody about the church and you weren't even supposed to tell them where the church services were. And they never got a church. Our church services were in high school gymnasiums sometimes. That changed over time gradually, but when I was a kid, it was just like they were always getting ready to go to the place of safety because the world was going to end. Mm-hmm. And we were the chosen ones and other people were not. And we were chosen by blood. So I believed that I was related to Jews. I believed and had been taught that my bloodline was the lost tribe of Israel, and that Ephraim was Britain and Manasseh was the United States. So I know that Herbert W. Armstrong was trying desperately to save people by putting that broadcast out there, but it was a contradictory message because then people couldn't find us. So it wasn't like, you know, we had a, oh, here, our doors are open, come to services. It was all very secretive. So it's like cults are crazy. They make you crazy because the stuff doesn't make sense. They contradict themselves. So from age 14 to 19, 5 years of my teen life, I was going to the cult. I was a member of the cult. And my boyfriend, I lost my virginity to a boy who was just 1 year older than me. So I was 17, he was 18. And his parents were longtime members of the church. They even babysitted some of the founder's kids or something. So they were connected to the founder. And he definitely believed in the church. And I was waffling. I went to college and hoping to get away from it, but I still felt the pull. And I felt my mother, of course, wanted me to go and wanted me to continue to be a member. And so I'm having all these behaviors that are against church doctrine. I'm drinking, I'm doing drugs, I'm having sex with boys. And still, I didn't dare say anything bad about the founder because literally, literally, I believed I would be struck dead with lightning. Mm-hmm. And the Old Testament has all kinds of stories about people invoking the wrath of God and being struck dead by lightning. And you got to understand, this cult preached Old Testament a lot. Mm-hmm. I really didn't know much about the Gospels, although they claimed to take the Bible in its entirety. We spent most of our time in Leviticus and Exodus getting inculcated with don't eat shellfish, don't eat pork. The fish have to have scales and fins. So we couldn't eat flounder even because it doesn't, if it's on the bottom of the ocean, it had to be swimming through the ocean free. And yeah, I don't know. It's kind of overwhelming how many roles there were, to tell you the truth. They told us whether or not we could wear makeup, and we weren't supposed to wear makeup. And then we were told we could wear a little bit of lip gloss, but it had to be a certain color. And then they told us what length our hems could be. And they had to be about an inch and a half below or above the knee. So you'd measure the middle of your knee, and an inch and a half above or an inch and a half below was fine. So I couldn't wear maxi dresses because those were the long dresses that hippies wore. And then hair, the boys' hair had to not touch the top of their ears. Yeah. I didn't realize it was a cult until maybe 15 years ago. That, and that's because the church fell apart. And when it fell apart, some of the people that were actually pastors in the church started talking about it being a cult, started talking about how the founder had raped his daughter, started talking about how the money had been misappropriated, started revealing all these secrets that we didn't know. So, you know, I was talking about this with my life partner. I said, if a fish is in water, it can't describe water to you. Mm-hmm. It could tell you what it's like to be out of the water. I was a rebellious teenager, so I left at 19, but I didn't leave because I thought it was a cult. I left because I was rejecting the Bible. I was rejecting God. I was rejecting religion. Programming is so powerful that when that church service I told you about that took place 4 years ago, I'm in my 50s. I went home. I'm a full-grown woman who has been married and raised some stepkids, and I've been all over the news debating sex worker rights. I am known as that. But the minister stands up there at the pulpit and says that if you close your eyes and breathe, you are talking to Satan. The next morning, I had a hard time doing my yoga practice mm-hmm. in my 50s. And I almost want to cry to tell you that, because I can't believe how powerful the fear and the programming still in my body, that this pastor, I don't even know him, but he speaks for the founder who's dead now, but he still speaks for him. He still speaks for the dogma that I was raised in. Mm-hmm. And it has such a powerful place lodged in my body that this yoga practice that I love, that I've been doing for 10 years, that has been such a healing place for me to get past trauma, that I would have a hard time doing that the next morning because of what he said. It was shocking to me.
Divergent journey.
I found drugs and alcohol. And that held the pain at bay, the pain of being sexually abused, the pain of watching my mother get hit, the pain of surviving a cult and not even know that I had, not even knowing that I'd been in a cult, just knowing I had religious trauma. That's what I called it. I called it religious trauma. And then when I was 25, I got clean and sober in a 12-step program. And that became my spiritual path. And it's non-denominational, it's a higher power of your understanding. My higher power started off as a female, I hate the male god I was raised with, and then turned into hermaphrodite because I was into queer rights, and then turned into a council of a group of them. And now I just don't care anymore. I like to meditate, I like to pray, I like yoga, and I've had a lot of psychic experiences since I got away from the fear. Psychic experiences were Satan. Yeah. That's what I was told. So the first time I had a psychic experience, I was afraid. And gradually I've been able to let go of that fear and realize it's just a normal part. We all have those experiences. And it's actually normal and beautiful. You know, one of the things that happened to me, because you were asking about prayer, and it was, I don't even think I should grace it with the word prayer, because there was no way I was having a conscious contact with a higher power. I was just reciting the things I was told I had to say. It was horrible. It was just horrible. I hated it. But when I was 17 and still living in my parents' home and still part of the cult, I became very suicidal, and understandably so. I've been abused so many ways. And so I was down by a river thinking about throwing myself into it. And I cried out and I said, does anybody care if I live or die? And in that moment, I felt a warm embrace enfold me. And I'd like to tell you that sent me on a spiritual path. It didn't. What it did was it saved my life. And I decided not to kill myself. And I don't know if I would have actually thrown myself into the river that day. It's kind of besides the point. I was on a path of, you know, I'm going to find some way to get check out. And I chose not to. And I thought somebody does care. And there is. And that was the first time I'd ever had a spiritual experience. First time. There's nothing spiritual about cults, in my opinion. It's not the one I was raised in. They're actually antithetical to spirituality. Try to beat it out of you with fear. You cannot have a conversation with a higher power of your understanding, because we're going to tell you what he says. And our founder used that in a self-serving way. So he told everybody we couldn't get divorces until he decided he wanted to marry a divorcee. Then he changed the rules. Just changed the rules willy-nilly, depending on what he wanted to do and what worked for him. And everybody, hundreds of thousands of people would have to, well, I guess tens of thousands of people would have to fall in line and do what he said. When I turned 25 and I got sober, same thing. I was wanting to die, and I was sent a couple dreams that made me decide to live. And that's when I fell to my knees of my own volition and prayed to get sober. And I've been sober now, clean and sober, for 36 years.
We'll be back in a moment with Veronica, Whitney, and Amy for part 2.
From the ashes deep inside, luminary, nothing left to hide behind. Unfold, house of paper built on streets of gold, fantasy.
Veronica Monet is an internal family systems relationship coach, and I asked Veronica to tell us more about the work she does now before we get started.
I work with some of people's traumas. I've got training as a domestic violence and a sexual assault counselor, and I'm an anger management coach, and I'm also a certified sexologist. So I work on a very deep level with people. And I love it. I love my work. I get to help people transform their lives and really connect with their hearts.
So, and do you see a lot of success with your clients?
I do.
Do you think that it's a thing that eventually at some point, I mean, I know that we carry trauma with us, but do you think there is a kind of release and hope for people?
Well, as a coach, I'm interested in results. That's the primary difference, I suppose. Therapy, as I've experienced it, and I have actually two therapists that I'm working with, is so much about processing those feelings. And so I'm bringing to them my feelings. As a coach, I'm results oriented. The client brings to me what they want to accomplish, what they want to achieve, the thing they're wanting to shift in their life. So if I'm not getting results, for instance, I worked with one couple that was having sexual and anger management issues in the marriage. Worked with them for about 4 years. And at one point, I just told them, look, here's the next steps you need to take. I have taken you as far as I can. And I really think that you need a combination of internal family systems with a licensed therapist or EMDR, which is another proven technique for treating trauma. But there's just so much denial about trauma. People are kind of going, I'm fine. Just help me stop arguing with my spouse. And the one thing that I don't refer out is domestic violence, which is itself very traumatic, but I'm a trained domestic violence counselor. So and that goes hand in hand with the anger management training. And I have had a lot of success with that. It's fabulous to take couples that are hurting each other emotionally and physically to a place where they don't have to do that anymore.
Beautiful. So, so all of these kind of taboo topics or things that kind of came up during your childhood into adulthood. And what would you say to people who have just listened to your story about this idea of how did you integrate yourself into society, kind of feeling like this. I'm really interested personally in knowing about like your sense of community, even though if it was something that was harmful to you as a person.
Right.
How do you let go of this kind of relationship with the people that you love and then enter into a new world? Did you separate from them too? Or do you, you know, what do you do with that?
That's a great question. First thing, I just want to back up a little bit and say, what would I say to anybody who's just listened to this interview? Is if you are having some strange sensation that you relate to my incredibly weird childhood and wonder what's going on, you wouldn't be the first. I have shared so much of my story at the public level and had people come up and they don't even know why they're crying. And what I want to say to that is that we are of the human family. And even though we can have different experiences and different traumas, we share some of the same pain. So it's more like a question that I would ask you to ask yourself, like, what does this remind me of? My life was different than Veronica's. I've experienced something very different than hers, but how does it touch into something? And it could be as easy as growing up in a family where you're not supposed to share family secrets. So that was the first thing I wanted to say. Leaving a cult. You know, it's interesting because I was fascinated that I left we called it the church. Of course, we didn't say, here's the thing about leaving a cult. Nobody says I'm leaving the cult. It's more like, oh, you've stopped going to the church, or you've stopped going to the groups, or you're leaving the family. That's the understanding that you have at the time. You're not thinking, oh, I'm leaving a cult. So I think it's very fascinating that my sister continued to attend the church services long into her adulthood. She had two children and was still going to church. And for her, it was so much about trying to get our parents' approval. But I think it was also a sense of she felt lost. And so that was her anchor. For me, it was very different. I felt controlled, confined, and constrained. I wanted so much to express my larger energies. And the cult was really making that impossible. I mean, anytime you're in a group where closing your eyes and taking a deep breath is cavorting with Satan, that's pretty limiting. That doesn't even take into consideration all the foods we weren't supposed to eat and the makeup we weren't supposed to wear, the clothes we weren't supposed to wear, and all of that behavior. But I had a much more rebellious side, and I wanted to get out and see what was going on in the world. A sense of being isolated and not even allowed to attend public school was just so overwhelming for me. So my sister continued to go to church, got married, had babies. I went to college and became very rebellious. And of course, you know, got myself into a certain amount of trouble too. But that was really for me. I formed new alliances and a new peer group. So I just took my need for membership and belonging to the college dormitory, which was not a real great choice. It was a lot of drinking and drugs and promiscuity, and that led to a certain amount of pain. But it was never as painful for me personally as being in this rigid, confining, hellfire, damnation, shaming cult.
So with the shame part too, though, was that a thing that you carried with you, though, even like in your kind of abuse period where you felt like you were a little bit wild there, or you were not a little bit, but maybe a lot?
a lot wild. This is the terrible. I always tell people, don't just give your kids a long list of don'ts, because they are going to rebel, probably. I mean, you know, maybe not. But if they do, boy, they're going to really cut loose. And I did. Amy, I did not feel any shame about that. My shame pertained to this weird childhood and membership in this strange cult. I felt embarrassed about that. I felt ashamed of that. I felt ashamed of, you know, my family of origin, which was, you know, my father came from transient fruit pickers. So a lot of class shame about the class that, you know, low income, poor, uneducated people that I originated from. So I tried to hide that stuff. Being homeschooled, I was ashamed of that. So I tried to invent a high school I never went to. Mm-hmm. Those were the things I hid. I actually flaunted the wild, promiscuous drug, alcohol stuff because it was my entry into mainstream culture. It was my way of getting approval from my college peer group.
But when you realized that this became an addiction, then what was it that, like, what was the event that kind of really just, you realized, okay, wait, something's got to change?
Well, there were several things. There was a long litany of things that all happened within quick succession of each other. And I'd say over the course of about 6 months, and it got to where it was like something every weekend. So I'd go to work and sit at my desk and do my job. And then the weekend was just horrible in a lot of ways. So what would happen was that one weekend, my fiance tried to commit suicide. And so we had to call the ambulance. And then the next weekend, he was actually in the under 72-hour hold for a whole week because of bad behavior. But when he finally came back home, then we had domestic violence. The cops were out there trying to break up physical violence between us. There was me getting a DUI. So I got arrested for drunk driving. And then the very next weekend after my DUI, I totaled my car by running into Lawrence Expressway. And Whitney knows where that is. So how do you do that? But I did. I just ran right into the expressway and totaled my car. And so I ended up going to see a psychologist through my HMO. And I said, you got to help me. Every weekend is some terrible thing happening and I just don't know what's going on. And he says, lady. And I remember I was 25 and I thought, who calls a 25-year-old lady? Nobody had ever called me lady. And here this guy was calling me lady. And he goes, lady, you're an alcoholic. And until you want to deal with that, I can't help you. And I was just horrified. I was like, I'm a college graduate. I am an office manager. And how dare you speak that way to me? So, but I had to prove him wrong. So for a whole 30-day period of time, I had no alcohol. I was so proud of myself that I went back to drinking. And within 3 weeks, I put a needle in my arm for the very first time in my life. Mm-hmm. So that is when I knew things had really gone off the rails. And fortunately for me, when my boyfriend got committed for the suicide attempt, he came home with a big book from AA. And if I hadn't been reading that, I probably wouldn't have known that there were ways to get help. That's it. And I give thanks every day. I start every single day with thank you for another day clean and sober.
Veronica, when you first kind of came into the realization of what your childhood really was that pre-sobriety or post-sobriety?
It would have been about, I'm going to say, a couple months before sobriety. Mm. And I'm going to tell you something, Whitney, there is just no way that I could have gotten sober if I wasn't already in therapy. But the reason I know I hadn't gotten sober yet was because I have a recollection of a therapist. I was in this support group for incest survivors. And she took me aside and she goes, it would be very helpful if you didn't drink before therapy. I was like, well, how am I supposed to handle this topic without a few drinks? Mm-hmm. But the thing is I really could not have coped with getting sober if I didn't have that therapy already in place. I just mm-hmm. couldn't have. Alcohol and drugs was the only thing keeping me from committing suicide.
Yeah. So then what was it like when you getting sober, but then also having this new realization? Because I would imagine there's some sort of cognitive dissonance that occurs when you recognize that your childhood was very different than you thought, or that what was going on was different, or was it not that different? Was it just like calling it by a different name? Like, oh, I always knew it was, you know, a bit overbearing and controlling, but now I realize it was actually a cult following that they were adhering to.
It is a slow unraveling. Mm. So the first thing is, yeah, I know my dad touched me in ways that I didn't like. And I asked him to stop and he wouldn't stop. Okay. Then in therapy, I'm going, oh, it has a name. We call that incest and child molesting. Oh, okay. Well, are you sure? Are you sure that's really what it is? Because I'm listening to some of the other people in this group, and it seems like what happened to them is far worse than what happened to me. So I just keep going back and forth between trying to minimize what I went through and thinking I don't really belong in here, which is, by the way, the same kind of experience that I had around alcoholism. I don't really belong in here. So it's like all this denial that's still operating and trying to minimize it and say, it couldn't have been that bad. And it wasn't until recently that I realized that the church I was raised in was a cult. And that is because the people my age who broke away from the cult did a whole video about how it was a cult, and they uncovered all the secrets. And then it turns out that the founder of our cult actually raped his own daughter and had a relationship with her well into her adult life for quite some time. All of that stuff comes out little by little by little. And each time you discover this new piece of truth, it's shocking. It rattles your world, your sense of reality. And I don't think that my system could have handled all of it being presented to me at first. I really don't. I think little by little is all I could handle.
The thing about it coming out into the public, even if it was later on, did you feel almost supported and less maybe not?
Yes. Yes. It's like a
denial. Like you're not exaggerating your thoughts or feelings.
Like, that's it. It's like all of a sudden you're like, oh, okay. Well, then that explains why it felt so terrible. That explains why it was so crazy. That explains why they told us. I mean, it's a very, being in a cult, it's so secretive. And I could never understand why they didn't want other people to know where our church services were. And we never actually had a church. We met in gymnasiums and stuff. And it was such a conflict because there was the headquarters in Pasadena that had beautiful buildings and Ambassador College. And so it seems like they're really putting themselves out there, and they got the magazines and the World Tomorrow broadcast on radio and television. And it's a really big deal. And it seems like, oh, we're really out in the open. And yet in Oregon, where I was attending the cult services, it was like we weren't supposed to tell anybody where we were meeting and when. Mm-hmm. It's bizarre. So when you find out, yeah, it's actually a cult, and here's all the other stuff that was going on, the corruption around the money, the way the father tried to get rid of his son because he was going to out him for the incest with his sister, it all starts to come together, and you start to go, oh, wow, they really lied to us, ripped us off. I think about all the times that my mother served me beans. And told me we had to cut costs on groceries because Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong was building a very special temple to God, just like King Solomon did. So yeah, the pieces fall in place. They start to fall in place and you go, oh, okay, now I'm getting it. I'm understanding. This guy was just a journalist who wanted to make some money.
That actually brings me back to your immediate family too. And like you said, your sister, when she stayed, did you have a period of separation from her? I mean, I'm kind of curious, like, how did you interact with your family? And
well, I was definitely the black sheep of the family. And you know, when my dad died, I was the executor of his estate. So I got all his old photos and letters, and I started reading letters where my sister is complaining to our dad that Satan is influencing me because of my life choices. Obviously it's Satan. You know, it's years later, but reading those letters really, it stung. I was like, are you kidding me? You know, my dad are like condemning me to hell behind my back. I didn't realize that was going on. What I knew is that my father had disowned me and didn't want me to come home. My sister seemed to have kind of helped precipitate that. And my mother just loved me through the whole thing. So sometimes I would humor her and go to church services with her, hated them. And, you know, in retrospect, I really think it's bizarre to me. I don't quite understand this connection, but you think about the fact that a pedophile founded this church, and pedophilia was not, there was only thing talked about in this cult was sex is bad. Mm-hmm. And it should be between a husband and a wife, a man and a woman, that's it. And, you know, so really sexually shut down and repressive. But behind the scenes, this guy is having sex with his daughter. And I think it's fascinating, confusing, sad, that incest survivors gravitate to the cult founded by this man. But I'm looking at my family and I'm looking at how my mom was an incest survivor and gravitated towards my father, who's also an incest survivor. And then the child molestation gets carried forward towards my sister and I. And I've been talking to some cousins of mine recently, and just it was true for all of us. And they were not in our religious cult. But I still think there's something about this particular cult that attracted people who were either survivors of molestation or actively molesting their kids. Mm-hmm. Maybe both.
For a person who is experiencing incest and they feel like they don't know really where to turn to, I mean, is there something that you could offer as a thought or advice?
Absolutely. First of all, I just want to say that no matter what type of incest, because it exists on a continuum, there's emotional incest and nobody's touching you at all. But they are maybe assigning a role to you that's inappropriate, like making you their partner, because somehow or another, the relationship with your mom or your dad isn't what they want it to be. So now they are basically bonding with you as if you were their spouse. So they may not touch you, but they've still incested you. And then there's all of these different levels of touch. It could be sexualizing you, flirting you with you, taking naked pictures of you, like my dad did when I was 6 and my sister was 4. And I'm not saying all naked pictures of your children are bad. I'm saying that if it felt sexual to you, it was. And you need to honor that and know that we can't compare pain. I remember one time telling, because my father never had sex with me. He touched my breasts and he touched my private parts, but he didn't have sex with me. And I felt like I have no right to be in these support groups for incest survivors. And I was addressing that to a woman who shared that when she was 8 years old, her father came into her bedroom, put a pillow over her head and took her virginity. And I thought, I have no right to be here. It was a brutal rape and she was only 8. But she told me, how dare you try to compare our pain? Your pain is just as powerful as mine and you have every right to be here and you keep coming back. So I just want to pass that on. It was so important and it saved my life. And I'm just so grateful that that survivor passed that on to me. So I want to pass that on first. Whatever happened to you, if it hurts, it's real. And unfortunately, sometimes we're going to remember things we forgot, and we're going to start to remember them in ways that we didn't see them initially. We might have thought it was innocuous, then we start to realize that it was harmful. You need to be around other survivors. There's just no two ways about it. To be able to talk to somebody else who survived being molested as a child, to me, is just, it's life. It's so important. Later on, my sister came out of denial about what happened to her, and we spent years unpacking our incestuous past. And it was so empowering and so healing to have that validation. And then ultimately, there are really only two forms of therapy that have the endorsement of Bessel van der Kolk, who is an expert in treating post-traumatic stress disorder. And a copy of his book, I highly recommend, The Body Keeps the Score. CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, does not have a proven track record. I'm not saying that it doesn't have some value. And I certainly have received lots of CBT over the years, but the really good stuff for me, the stuff that really did the heavy lifting, is EMDR and IFS. And don't take my word for it, just get a copy of the book and read all about how the best ways to treat trauma. There's also something about getting into the body that's really important. So there are there's trauma-informed yoga and there's art therapy. And I think some of those things just kind of take you back to your child and start freeing you up. But I do yoga. I've found it very beneficial. But anyway, those are the three resources I'd say. Check out The Body Keeps the Score. Find an IFS therapist or an EMDR therapist.
Yeah, I actually interviewed somebody, I'll put this also in the show notes, that who is an EMDR therapist, and she has explains what it is. So I'll just pop that in the show notes if anybody's interested so they can learn more about that.
Yeah.
So I also have another question about, I mean, I think also you were just kind of bringing it back a little bit, like touching upon minimizing your minimizing your trauma.
Yeah. Yeah.
This other person said, don't, you know, you're valid and you're held and seen, you know, in your own experience. But one of the things is that, did you ever like question your own memory or feel?
So what happens when you are traumatized as a child, and particularly sexual abuse, is you leave your body a lot of the time. And being outside your body makes the memories and what's happening feel like it's happening to somebody else, or maybe you watched it in a movie. So oftentimes when I'm talking to somebody who says, well, I don't know if that really happened, I go, okay, well, I'm sorry. Maybe it did, maybe it didn't. I'm not going to make that call for you, but I just want to say that's one of the symptoms, is thinking I made this up. Mm-hmm. I imagined it. It's really common.
Do you think maybe because children too, a lot of times, you know, adults kind of dismiss them, or their opinions are not respected. And so even like it's ingrained in us, maybe that, especially as a small person, that, you know, we're not, our thoughts or our feelings are not valid, or, you know, because even what I was just thinking about was that I was listening to somebody, I have no idea where I listened to this to, so I can't credit whatever it is, but it was somebody talking about how when we talk to children, or we ask them, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And everything is possible. You know, they really believe that, yes, I can do anything. And then parents often kind of like dismiss them, like, okay, yeah, sure, honey, without really embracing that. So I was just, I don't know really where I'm going with this, but I was just kind of thinking about that, about how we dismiss them. So maybe,
actually in my childhood, I started confronting my father about the molestation when I was 15 and my sister was 13. And I think he suffered from dissociative amnesia. And I'm not saying that because he denied what was going on. I say it because of the fact that my dad seemed to have two sides to him, that they didn't talk to each other. But the side that didn't know what he was doing said that, literally looked at me and said, you're crazy. I do not know what you're talking about. So I thought, okay, there's something wrong with my daddy. Now, I thought there had been something wrong with my daddy since I was 4. I thought his behavior is weird. It's not normal. It's not right. Now, as a 4-year-old, I know that. And then at 8 years old, daddy just is so perfect and he knows everything. And then at 9 years old, I'm like, well, daddy's weird. And then he's sick. There's something wrong with him. And at 15, I'm thinking, well, I know he loves me. So if I tell him that he needs to stop what he's doing, he'll stop it because he loves me. And I find out, no, actually, there's another part in there. And this is one of the reasons I love IFS, because it's internal family systems. We look at the sub-personalities. He had a sub-personality that I think was a narcissistic abuser. And very cold, very, very cold, without feeling, without empathy. And I encountered that part of him. It was chilling. But he, around the same time, he was on disability. And the insurance company compelled him to go see a therapist, a psychologist, to get find out if this was all in his head. And I remember thinking, oh, thank God, finally, an expert is going to rescue our family from this madness, this terrible, terrible thing happening to us. And he came back and he says, I got a clean bill of health. I'm perfectly normal. So in that moment, being homeschooled and in this crazy cult and isolated from the rest of the world, I concluded that apparently I'm the one that's crazy. Mm. So yeah, that was hard, really hard.
Yeah. And do you think like ancestral wounds can be healed then too?
I absolutely do. I want to tell you something. The book that I'm working on right now, which has no title, just I'm letting it come through me however it's going to come. But it's so much about growing up in the cult, growing up in where both families of origin are just rife with pedophilia. That is really a huge undertaking to heal that family trauma. And it's not just for future generations and the people that are still alive, my cousins, my sister. It's, I believe that there's, you know, there is some strange thing about time. Can it reach back into the past and heal the past? I don't know. I'm not like an expert in quantum physics, but I do believe that healing that trauma in my DNA somehow or another creates some healing even for my aunts and uncles that have passed on. If I didn't believe that, it'd be pretty hard for me. I love them. They did horrible, horrible things. And I love them and I want healing for this family. Mm-hmm. I really think the thing that's important here is to find a way. I really believe we have to move away from cancel culture. Mm-hmm. Cancel culture is creating in us a lot of denial about our own perpetrations. Everybody's hurt somebody somehow. And, you know, I'm very grateful that I did not carry forward the sexual perpetrations of my forebears. But in a lot of ways, it's an accident of birth. It's the fact that I was born when incest was starting to be talked about, when a lot of lesbian feminists were surfacing this. I just want to bow down at their feet and thank them so much that they had the courage to do what Freud didn't have the courage to do. And here we are now at a time when we absolutely know that this happens to children. We want to call it out and we want organizations that are facilitating to stop it. But we've also got a certain amount of hysteria out there where people are seeing pedophilia where it doesn't even exist. And I really believe that's because of the taboo to find it in your own home, your own school, your own church. It's always the other guy, the other people that are doing it. And that's just not true. And we have to have the courage to now start looking at the perpetrations that are happening in our own circles and build not a cancel culture where these people then become bad. Who's going to do that? We love the people in our family. Mm-hmm. We may love our minister or our priest. So the only way we can actually start stopping the harm is to have a way towards accountability and healing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the damage with cancel culture is that it does just create this greater divide between, you know, this taboo concept of that, you know, anyone who's ever harmed somebody else is horrible and should be condemned. And just as you said, first off, people who have make those acts usually have them enacted upon themselves. Right. And also, as we've also discussed, they're humans. And whether or not they did an inflicted, you know, pain on someone else, they still did. You don't have to condone something by not condemning it. When you condemn someone, you condemn their human spirit. And then we get this message that says, oh gosh, I can't take that on. And then it just becomes, everything becomes more secretive. You know, everything becomes more where nobody's going to want to find these incidences happening because they're like, well, if that happens, it's the end of everything. So people won't come forward. And it just becomes more and more stigmatized to those who it happens to. Where the reality is that, you know, I hope in the future it becomes if that happens to someone, they can have a better understanding of what it is and what they can do about it. And that the person who's doing it can get help as well and be seen as someone who's suffering rather than someone that deserves to be locked away for the rest of their life as a monster.
Absolutely, Whitney. And I'm thinking, obviously, Me Too wasn't about pedophilia per se, but I'm thinking about there were some brave men who came forward and said, I have perpetrated some Me Too moments. And they got slammed. And so what does that say to anybody else who might want to come forward and get help and call it out? Don't do that. So then psychologically, I think a lot of people start justifying and minimizing their behavior.
Absolutely. Well, I think that was an unfortunate effect of Me Too, was like no one wanted to be over that bar. So they, from then on, it was, you know, trying to limit it because I think that if we had let more people come up and say, I did that, and not, but more so in try to embrace them and work with them for rehabilitation and, you know, therapy and all of that. But the more that it's condemned, the more people are going to, you know, I mean, honestly, it kind of goes back to when I think of a cult idea, where it's that rigid, dogmatic idea where it's like, you either follow this or you are out. And that's what cancel culture is you either do what everyone says if you do what you're not supposed to do, then you are gone. You are gone.
Yeah.
You know? And so people are going to adhere to things, whether or not they really believe in them, whether it's true for them, which is what I think of again as a cult. It's like, well, this guy seems really sure about what he believes. And so I'm going to go with this. And also I'm kind of afraid not to, because of everything that they're telling me about what happens to people who don't go along with this. So in a way it's, we're creating a cult of ideas around that.
Yeah. It's borrowing from the very system we're trying to dismantle.
Exactly.
So we're trying to dismantle a system that's predicated on secrets and shaming.
Yeah.
By shaming people and driving them further into secrets.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's exactly it. It's the shaming part. And honestly, I feel like I've seen that more in the past, you know, 5-6 years than ever, because politically, socially, everything that's been going on, we've been addressing things that, which are so great to talk about, but the shame has just really flooded in. And I think it makes people feel like they can only have one opinion or one view.
Oh yeah. There's, I mean, I'm taking on this topic, but one thing at a time. I have to tell you, there's certain beliefs and feelings that I have that I'm not going to talk about publicly, because I just don't need the headache that comes with that.
Right. And I think that's so sad, because you live through it. So you're allowed to whatever opinions and thoughts and beliefs that you have.
And I think all of us are experiencing that. We are all, thanks to the cancel culture right now, we're all, regardless of where you are on the political spectrum, whether you're conservative, liberal, or progressive, or libertarian, wherever you are, there's something you feel like you can't say right now because you're afraid of being canceled.
Yeah.
So we're really tamping down the free exchange of ideas.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I also feel like this is silencing women a little bit more than even men, because it's kind of traditionally, while we're trying to dismantle, you know, or come into the more balanced, like divine feminine and divine masculine mix, if we keep silencing people, that's never going to happen. Thank you, audience, for listening. And please leave a review. Let us know what you think. You can leave us a voicemail message. There's a link in the show notes. And we'd love to hear from you, or send us an email. You can send it to hello@themindfulsoulcenter.com. And we thank you. Until next
time. Thanks for listening. See you next time.